Welcome to Politics and Science. I'm your host, John Barkhausen. Today's edition of Politics and Science features a conversation I had with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, a nonprofit dedicated to ending America's use of nuclear power and to promoting power sources that are least harmful to the environment. You can find out more about Michael Marriott and the Nuclear Information Resource Service by visiting their website. It's nirs.org. And now here's our conversation recorded on the 7th of April, 2011. I notice on your webpage you have the Union of Concerned Scientists have released internal Nuclear Regulatory Commission emails showing that there's some dispute going on about the U.S. GE Mark I reactors. What do you know about that?
Well, the NRC has been, for a couple of years now, conducting new studies of reactors and vulnerabilities to accidents. And do we really think that the purpose of these studies is to try to show that there would be few, if any, consequences of a nuclear accident? I mean, they're trying to replace earlier studies that, you know, had quite horrific accident consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of doing this, one of the reactors they've been examining, they usually pick a few reference reactors. You know, they don't try to do every reactor in the country. So one of the reactors they picked was at Peach Bottom, Pennsylvania, which is a GE Mark I reactor. And they've done simulations to see how well the reactor would survive in a station blackout accident, which is, of course, the exact scenario that we've had at Fukushima. And apparently there's quite a dispute among the NRC safety people working on this study about whether Peach Bottom, in fact, would survive such an accident and how quickly things would fall apart. And it looks like, at least from the documents that UCS has released, that Peach Bottom, at least, and this is probably true of all the other GE Mark I reactors out there, there's 23 of them in the U.S., quite vulnerable to this scenario, and if you had loss of power for a couple of days, we could expect to see the same types of things we're seeing at Fukushima.
Hmm. Yeah, that's scary. Here in Vermont, I noticed looking at, I think, a link from your page, I saw a map of all the Mark I reactors in the country, and we have two of them about 200 miles to the west of us at Oswego, I think, New York.
Well, you have Nine Mile Point in Oswego.
Yeah.
Nine Mile Point Unit 1. You have Vermont Yankee, which is in Vermont.
That's right.
Of course.
Of course.
Pilgrim is to the east in Massachusetts. So, yeah, you have several of them up there.
Yeah. So, and I know you guys at the Nuclear Information Resource Service are running a campaign to shut down all the Mark I reactors as a first step to phasing out nuclear. And I was wondering how that's going.
Well, about 7,000 people have now written to their Congress members and the NRC and President Obama demanding that these be closed. We're trying to, there's been a lot of media interest in the issue, and certainly these latest UCS revelations will, I think, spark more interest in the issue.
Mm.
It's not something that's going to be easy to do by any means. The NRC so far has refused to acknowledge that there are any lessons to be learned from Fukushima. In fact, at Oyster Creek, New Jersey, which is a Mark I, it's the oldest reactor operating in the U.S., they were compelled by a federal court to answer why they just gave it a license extension in light of the events at Fukushima. And the NRC replied yesterday or 2 days ago, I guess, saying that there really aren't any lessons to be learned that would apply to Oyster Creek. And that's just, you know, fundamentally, you know, playing the role of ostrich sticking their heads in the sand. So it's not going to be easy, but it is something that we're committed to pursuing.
Yeah. I always find it fascinating that, in a sort of morbid way, why, when a disaster like this happens, the reaction of the people proposing this technology is to, you know, yell even louder that the, you know, the renaissance, the nuclear renaissance, will continue, and there's no problem. And what,
well,
what,
we're certainly seeing that a lot in Congress right now.
Yeah,
there's been several hearings over the past 2 weeks on, you know, Fukushima and its implications, and we're certainly hearing from a lot of Congress members that, you know, can't happen here, can't happen here, and they just, you know, and I don't think anybody is in a position to say that it can't happen here based on what is known so far about this accident.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like all it actually would take to have the same thing happen here is to have a power failure at any one of those Mark I plants.
Well, you would need a power failure plus failure of the backup power systems. And the questions are, you know, how good are our backup systems? We basically have the same types of battery systems as they had at Fukushima, and the same types of emergency diesel generators, which, of course, in Fukushima's case, were destroyed by the tsunami. In our case, most of the reactors are not threatened by tsunamis, but diesel generators also have a pretty spotty history of reliability, and they aren't really designed to operate for long periods of time. So if you had an extended blackout, and there are many different possible causes of a blackout. It doesn't take an earthquake or a tsunami to cause a blackout. Our reactors would be vulnerable, and we believe the Mark I's would be the most vulnerable.
Nuclear reactors, due to the needs for water to cool them, are often located on bodies of water or rivers, and of course that means they're prone to flooding. And are all the Mark I reactors, do they all have their electrical connection stations in a subterranean location? Because that was one of the problems with the tsunami at the Fukushima plant. And it doesn't take a tsunami necessary to flood a basement. So I was wondering if that's a common attribute to these Mark I's.
I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
I
think you have to look at it on a site-specific basis.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 60s and 70s when these reactors were built, there was no such thing as a standardized design where every plant was identical. I suspect they're different at every plant. I know some of them have their emergency diesel generators elevated so that in the event of a large flood, it wouldn't reach the generators.
That would be smart.
I don't know if all of them do or not.
Yeah. Let's hope
so. But the basic design flaws of the Mark I's, which are a small, weak outer containment building, a fuel pool on top of the reactor core, inside this small, weak outer containment building, you know, those are fundamental flaws.
And
you know, you couldn't license a reactor like that today. The Atomic Energy Commission staff back in the early 70s recommended against licensing it back then. NRC's top safety official in 1986 after Chernobyl, you know, made a now famous quote that, you know, these reactors would, containments would fail 90% of the time under accident conditions. And, you know, we've now seen splashed across international TV screens exactly what happens to these reactors under accident conditions.
Mm. Are all the Mark I's, do they all have their fuel pool above the reactor?
Yes. Yeah, that was a design element in the Mark 1s. It's not exclusive to the Mark 1s. I think some of the other reactors may have it too, but it is definitely a feature of the Mark 1s. The pools are outside the primary containment, which is the primary containment basically surrounds the reactor vessel itself. It doesn't extend beyond that. So it's, the pools are located in this outer building, which is not particularly strong, can't withstand hydrogen explosions, as we've seen. And it was done for efficiency reasons. And it is certainly an efficient way to do things. You take the fuel rods out of the core, you'll have these cranes, and they lift them straight up out of the core. And then they can, these cranes can just make a 90-degree turn and drop the, and by drop I mean place, the fuel rod into the pool. It's no transportation, you don't have to move it anywhere. It's very efficient and easy to do under normal operation, but of course it does make the pools vulnerable in situations that we've seen in Japan.
Yeah. Have you been able to look at the NRC assessment of Fukushima?
No, it's not a public document. We put in a formal request for it yesterday morning.
I can tell you it is available. Fair Winds Associates, Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson's website actually has.
Do they have it now?
They have a link to it. If you go to their homepage,
I'll check that out.
Yeah, fairwinds.com.
But we did put in a formal request with the chairman's office yesterday.
Yeah.
I should just point out that this document that was reported in the New York Times yesterday is regularly updated.
Oh, I see.
So that was a snapshot document from March 26th that was reported. So it's about it's more than a week old now.
Yeah.
We have reason to believe that the conditions and issues that were identified in that document are that the NRC still believes them to be the case.
And what's your take on what is actually happening over at Fukushima right now? What are my understanding is that reactors 5 and 6 are actually stable, and the other 4 are in various stages of trouble.
That's correct. 5 and 6, they've been able to hook up off-site power and cool them, pretty much normally. 5 and 6 did have holes punched into their containments at one point to release hydrogen to avoid pressure buildup, hydrogen buildup. So they're not in a safety situation that one would want for long-term operation or anything.
Right.
But they are stable. Units 1 through 4 are in various degrees of problems. It's believed that Unit 1 basically has no water in the core, which means the fuel is probably continuing to melt.
And that's considered a meltdown?
At this point, it's still a partial meltdown. I don't think it's, they're continuing to put water into it. Apparently it's just not keeping water in it. And actually, all three, units 1, 2, and 3, none of them have water completely covering the core right now, to the best of our knowledge. Unit 1, they're injecting, they started this yesterday, injecting nitrogen into the containment to try to counter additional hydrogen buildup because there's a fear of more hydrogen explosions. They haven't said yet whether they're going to do this at Units 2 and 3, but it probably would be a prudent move. We don't know why they haven't, if there's technical reasons or exactly what the problem is, but why they haven't done it at these two other units.
Yeah.
Unit 4, it's become clear from this NRC assessment Department actually had suffered a hydrogen explosion in its fuel pool earlier on, and released a high levels of radiation that may be where much of the off-site radiation has come from, although it's somewhat difficult to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there's been pretty much agreement among the world's nuclear bodies that this is going to be a mess for months.
That they're not going to be able to.
It's sort of like the BP oil spill. They just kept going and going and going, and it looks like this is going to just keep going and going, and there is, things could go bad at any time. I mean, there are some signs of improvement, but things still could deteriorate again at any time.
Yeah, and it's four reactors, unlike Chernobyl's one.
Correct. There's a lot more radioactive inventory there. And we're seeing, I think, particularly the Austrians, which monitor the collections of radiation monitoring stations around the world, have estimated that the cesium releases, for example, from Fukushima are now around half of those that we saw at Chernobyl. So, we're seeing a pretty large accident here.
Mm. Arnie Gunderson in the Fair Winds site, fairwinds.com, has a little info video that he's been putting out periodically. And the current one, he has apparently seen a assessment of the situation by Areva executives. And I guess... Mm-hmm. Some Areva vice president was quoted as saying that this is probably the worst nuclear disaster in history, or will be.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If we have a facility like this with multiple units continuing to release radiation for an extended period, it is certainly possible we're going to see Chernobyl's, when this is all done, over and done with, at some point, we're going to see comparable releases to Chernobyl and perhaps more. Too early to tell. I guess if there's a saving grace, it's that this is an ocean plant on an island, and the prevailing winds have been toward the ocean and away from land.
Yeah.
Not exclusively. And the contamination levels on land are highest to the northwest of the site. But, the bulk of the radiation release so far has gone out into the air over the ocean and into the water, into the seawater itself.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't bode well for the ocean, I suppose, but at least it's not going
to... Yeah, I mean, it does dilute in the ocean, and water is a shield for radioactivity, certainly, but what we're going to be seeing, in terms of long-term consequences, is the cesium that's been going into the ocean is going to drop down and get caught in the, get into the ocean floor, into the sediment around the area, and cause problems for sea life in the area for quite a long time, potentially centuries. What will be important is to know what the tidal patterns are, so we can know where the where these deposits are occurring, and exactly how much of it is going to be there.
There's been some talk about plutonium in the fuel. Can you explain what that's about?
Well, two things. First, all reactors create plutonium as part of the fission process. Plutonium has been found outside the reactor buildings, so it has been released. They have actually, I'm about to post on our website information that they found more than was announced last week. They've done some more samplings and found some more. Not large amounts, but low levels, about 500 meters from the reactor building. But the other plutonium issue is that Unit 3 at Fukushima Daiichi began partially using MOX fuel last fall. MOX stands for mixed oxide. It's a fuel made from reprocessed nuclear materials, and mixed oxide means it's both plutonium and uranium. So about 5% of the core of Unit 3 was this mixed oxide fuel. So the problems with mixed oxide fuel are that in the event of a situation like this, the types of materials that can be released are hotter and potentially more hazardous than even in a normal uranium-powered reactor. But we don't know at this point whether the plutonium that's been found has come from which reactor it has come from, or potentially fuel pools, because, like I said, the normal uranium reactors produce plutonium during their operation.
What's going on over here with Obama and Energy Secretary Chu's? They've been pushing for a nuclear renaissance, which surprised many people who thought Obama was going to be for true renewables and not nuclear. Could you give a little history on the subsidies that nuclear power needs to actually operate?
Yeah. Wall Street does not want to invest in nuclear power plants, period. And certainly Fukushima is not likely to change that situation at all. Instead, it's a reminder that multi-billion dollar investments can become multi-billion dollar liabilities virtually overnight. For whatever the cause, whatever the reason, and leaving aside the safety consequences and all that, it's just on a pure economic basis. TEPCO just lost a lot of power and a lot of money, and Wall Street, is not interested in those kinds of risks. So it's another reminder of that. But Wall Street wasn't particularly interested in nuclear power, even when it wasn't thinking about those kinds of risks. When they were just thinking about the economic risks of budget overruns and high costs generally, and potentially utilities building reactors and not being able to sell the power at a rate that would allow them to repay their loans. So Wall Street's been sitting on the sidelines, and it's become clear that the only way new reactors could be built in this country is through federal what are called loan guarantees, which in fact have turned out to be loans from the Federal Treasury to utilities to help them build the reactors. One loan guarantee has been offered so far, a little over a year ago, to the Southern Company to build two new reactors in Georgia. There is about $10.5 billion remaining in a fund for this purpose. And last year President Obama requested an additional $36 billion for this purpose. Congress did not give it to him despite several efforts to approve that money or lesser amounts. And for this fiscal year, the president has again asked for $36 billion more for this program. We fought very hard last year. We will be fighting very hard again this year. And particularly this year, the entire premise of the program, is it just the policy. policy premise of the program no longer makes sense. The premise was that, Wall Street is, nervous about investing in nuclear power because of, potential high costs and cost overruns and delays. If the government gives them some money, gives the utilities some money for the first few plants, and they can be built, basically on time and on budget, then Wall Street will have enough confidence to step in and, finance additional plants. But, that, after Fukushima, that's just clearly not going to happen. So, the premise of the program no longer makes sense. Whatever nuclear renaissance we have in this country will be however much the government wants to blow it up. Those are the plants that have a shot at getting built, and nothing else does.
I see. And what are the prospects look like now for them getting the $36 billion that they're asking for?
Difficult to say. I mean, there's, as I mentioned earlier, there's still a lot of congressional support for nuclear power. There is also a lot of congressional support for cutting the federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
And this program is was not popular before Fukushima. NBC Wall Street Journal poll taken in early March found it actually to be the most popular program among the public to cut. And the polls taken since then show that three quarters of the American people do not want taxpayer money going to build new reactors. So that's a pretty powerful statement. We know that there is no money in the continuing budget resolution that's being discussed currently for the program, no new money.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just have to see how it plays out once they finally get around to working on next year's budget. But it's something that we and others will be fighting. It makes no sense to commit billions of dollars of taxpayer money to an industry that clearly is not going to revive itself, especially in the United States.
If people wanted to get involved with the Nuclear Information Resource Service in stopping this taxpayer funding of nuclear power plants, how would they do that?
People can go to our website, www.nirs.org. You can sign up for our email alert list where we let you know when people can take actions and what actions are effective. We try to make it as easy as possible for people to write their Congress members and other officials. And we're also, by the way, been including updates on the situation at Fukushima on near daily basis for the last 3.5 weeks, and sometimes more than once a day.
Mm-hmm.
We try to pull together information from all the different sources we receive. Some of our information comes directly from Japan, some from other places, but we try to figure out what's reliable. There's been a lot of hoax information out there as well, so we try to sift through it and make sure that we're putting up only things that we can document and that are reliable.
Yeah. Well, it's a great website, nirs.org. And you are a nonprofit?
Yes, we are decidedly nonprofit.
Okay. So if people wanted to help out in your work, they can do that too at that website.
Absolutely. And it's most appreciated.
Okay. And what do you make of I hear there's some discussion going on at the EPA of raising the permissible radiation exposure standards in the event of some kind of nuclear catastrophe. Is that related to what's Fukushima, or is that just something they were considering doing anyway? And what exactly are they considering raising the exposure levels to?
No, this is something that well predates Fukushima, really comes out of concern about terrorists using dirty bombs or that kind of thing. And the issue is, at what levels would they allow people, should people be allowed to, for example, return to a contaminated zone after a nuclear power accident or after a dirty bomb attack or some other major nuclear catastrophe. And because under the current guidelines, which we believe are probably not even strict enough, but certainly somewhat protective, if the unthinkable happened and some sort of nuclear device went off in a large city, people might not be able to live in that large city or portions of that large city for quite a long time. So the EPA has been working on plans to increase the allowable amounts, and we've been involved in this for it's been about 2 years now, working against increasing allowable amounts in this kind of event. And recently the big stir has been again some internal emails that were obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by a government whistleblower group called PEER, P-E-E-R.
What is that again, Michael?
It's called PEER, P-E-E-R, and I don't recall the full name, unfortunately. Something responsibility, but in any case, these emails show that some EPA officials are objecting to the proposed guidelines and pointing out that they're so high in some cases that drinking water at levels suggested in these guidelines could actually make you vomit from radiation sickness. Extremely high levels. Now I should point out that there is no finished document here, and the levels that are being bandied about in the media may not be the final recommendations, and we're going to be continuing to work to not increase for EPA to not increase its levels, and we'll see what they end up actually proposing. Right now they're not at the stage where they're actually out there proposing a final rule.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that update on that. And one other question concerning the funding of nuclear power plants. I don't know what the correct term is, but I understand down south, perhaps in North or South Carolina, and maybe other states, that nuclear power plants are being funded by asking ratepayers to prepay for their construction. And is that still going forward?
Right. That is the one other way some reactors could get built in this country. The policy known as CWIP, C-W-I-P, which stands for Construction Work in Progress. And it's only possible in regulated states, states that have deregulated electricity systems. This option is not available. So that's pretty much limited to the Southeast and a handful of Midwestern states. Most other states have deregulated. What happens is if the utility has a friendly public service commission, which in the Southeast most of them do, the rate are essentially serving as the bank for the utilities, and they collect the money from the ratepayers before construction of the plant begins. In the cases of South Carolina and Georgia right now, they're collecting money from ratepayers before these projects even have a license to build a reactor.
Wow.
There are no licenses out there right now to build new reactors in this country. So they're collecting the money from ratepayers, and will continue collecting money from ratepayers as, you know, assuming they get a license and start building these things as construction goes along. And that sort of turns the entire model of utility financing on its head, because the tradition has always been customers don't pay for a power plant of any kind until it's used and useful, meaning that it's been built and it works and it's providing electricity. Customers should be paying for the electricity that they're consuming, not for the not serving as a bank for utilities that otherwise couldn't afford to build anything. But again, you know, it is limited to a handful of states.
I was wondering, they can't go ahead and build without a license, can they?
No, they can't build. They are able to do some limited work, mostly site clearing activity, which is underway in South Carolina and Georgia. And you know, in site clearing for a nuclear plant is actually pretty involved and requires a lot of people. I think they have, you know, 1,000 people working right now in at the Georgia site doing this work. By site clearing, I mean it includes everything up to site preparation, and you know, but they can't actually build any safety or, you know, major component-related buildings until they have a license.
So are the ratepayers there basically making mortgage payments for the the power company at this point on the full amount that the reactor will cost, or are they just paying as the work is done? Do you know?
Well, they're paying a set rate approved by the public service commissions in those two states. You know, the basic, you know, rate increases with the money earmarked for the construction.
Yeah, and I would imagine that would be something that would be somewhat significant on their bill. And is there any opposition that's being generated because of that?
Well, there certainly has been opposition, especially in Georgia. But you know, in these two states, the public utility commissions are, you know, pretty much beholden to the utilities and have dismissed the opposition. Now that both states, however, do have clauses that would allow them to that require them to review the projects periodically, and that would allow them to, you know, cut off the funding if there were you know, if the Public Service Commission felt that the expenses were getting too high, or there were major cost overruns. So there is that possibility, but, you know, at least given that the current makeup of these commissions, it's not very likely.
Yeah, and I wonder if the project gets canceled, if the public will be refunded that money.
Don't count on it.
Okay, because that would seem only fair.
Fairness doesn't really play into this, I don't think.
Yeah, I see. All right, well, Michael Marriott, we're talking to at the Nuclear Information Resource Service. That's NIRS.org. Is there anything that I'm forgetting to ask you that's going on that's important for people to know about?
Well, you know, there's just so many issues that have you know, really arisen over the last month, most of which were actually there before but not receiving as much attention. Just one I'll mention real very briefly is, yeah, we touched on a little bit, but it's the radioactive waste issue. And, you know, there's certainly a movement underfoot to take as much waste as possible out of the fuel pools and put them into dry cask storages. U.S. reactors typically have far more waste in their fuel pools than did the Fukushima reactors, meaning that you have a much larger inventory of radiation in there event something goes wrong, as you saw Fukushima, and so you would have much higher radiation releases. So there's certainly some thought that there's a way too much waste in these pools, and that they would be safer taking as much of it out of the pools as possible. They can't take it all out because it has to cool for at least 5 years in the pools.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the older ways, taking it out and putting it in dry casks and putting these casks in berms and hardening them to protect them from natural disasters or you know, terrorists with shoulder-fired missiles and things like that, which is, you know, certainly possible to do, but it's not being done now.
I see. So that would be an important step to have done across the country.
Yeah, yes, we believe so, and there's a lot more attention being paid to that concept right now.
I was looking at your website, and you have a protective measures from radioactivity in North America. I think we're being told by the news media that there's nothing to worry about here, and they're just reporting what our authorities are saying and the government. What's your take on whether Americans have to worry about the fallout? I'm sure we're getting some fallout from Japan.
Well, yeah, there's the entire world, you know, or at least the entire northern hemisphere, is going to be getting fallout from Japan. And for some time to come, I mean, we're still, you know, there's still cesium in the atmosphere that came from Chernobyl that circulates the globe. So, yeah, we are going to be seeing that. We generally agree with the government that the levels that we've seen are not terribly significant. And don't require a lot of protective action. We don't recommend that people be taking potassium iodide, for example, which protects against radioactive iodine.
Mm-hmm.
Very appropriate for people in Japan to be taking it. Not so much in the U.S. because we're not expecting potential doses at the levels that would require that. You know, there are some potential side effects to potassium iodide, and those might be worse than, you know, what people are actually getting from the levels of iodine we're seeing. The main things we're recommending is, in particular, on the West Coast, but it's generally good advice right now across the country, is, you know, don't stand out in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't let yourself get drenched, because when there are radioactive particles in the atmosphere, they're more likely to be to come down to where people are in the rain, and that would be the, you know, sort of the main protective measure that we think is probably a good idea. The other thing that we're suggesting is that people ask their water suppliers for, you know, to publicly announce, you know, measurements of the possible radiation in the water supplies. We're not seeing anything that would give us cause for alarm, but I mean, the one thing that we are seeing that we think is basically disgraceful is at the governmental level, information going out that suggests that radiation from this accident, or, you know, any other accident, is comparable to the background radiation that we all receive, you know, from the sun and natural sources.
Mm.
Because the problem, the crucial difference is that when you ingest radioactive iodine or radioactive cesium or any of the other alphabet soup of radionuclides out there, it has a different effect. And that's why radiation levels in the water supplies are important. radiation levels in milk is important. There has been, at least out in Washington State, at least one case where some, not terribly elevated, but, you know, elevated enough to measure iodine in milk has been found. And, you know, you don't want babies drinking milk with radioactive iodine in it.
Because that goes straight to their thyroid gland, which is key for...
Right. And when you're taking it internally in milk, it's, you know, much more significant to the body than, you know, when it's external.
Yeah.
So, and we've just seen a lot of misinformation about that. I mean, we don't think there's any cause for panic in North America over the radiation from Fukushima, at least, you know, from releases that we've seen so far. But, you know, you do have to have a certain awareness that, you know, radiation is dangerous. And, you know, and there will be some cancers caused by, in the North America from this radiation. There, you know, it won't be enough to show a spike in the cancer rate, given, you know, how many cancers there are in, you know, this country every year. You're not going to notice the few additional ones that are going to occur statistically, but that doesn't mean they're not going to occur. They are.
Right, because even, I think everybody agrees there is no safe level of radiation.
Right, there is no safe level, and, you know, the lower the level, the less likely, you know, the lower the level any individual receives, the less likely they are to develop cancer because of it. But it, you know, some small percentage of people exposed to this, you know, and by small percentage, I mean very small percentage, of people exposed to the radiation from Fukushima in North America are going to get cancer from it, and there's probably nothing you can do about it.
And there's a cumulative effect of radiation, too, because your body tends to hang on to it, especially with the nasty ones like strontium-90 and stuff like that. And what I was wondering is, I know that the nuclear power plants are allowed to release radioactive gases and stuff in the normal, in their normal operating procedure. It's they're allowed to release it in relation to what the natural background radiation is. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a policy, it's called as low as reasonably achievable, which is a very important qualifying words in there. Reactors do release gases from time to time to avoid hydrogen buildups and pressure buildups and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's just part of routine operation. The levels are low. They're not as low as they could be because you have those word, that word reasonably in there. By that they mean, you know, essentially economically. you know, they're not going to require the utilities to put in everything possible to prevent releases on the grounds that the releases are low.
Yeah.
But they do happen, and people in their power plants do get exposed to them. And again, you know, you don't see, you generally do not see enough cancers to make a to be statistically significant in the larger realm of cancers from all causes, but it doesn't mean they're not occurring. And, you know, we certainly have seen in at least a few places, you know, cancer clusters that are, you know, somewhat suspicious. But, you know, you can't tell from any cancer what caused it.
Right. Yeah, it's very hard to trace back, although... you know, leukemia and certain types of cancer, I think, are known to come from nuclear, man-made nuclear technology.
There are certainly cancers that, you know, that radiation is a known cause of, but it is, I don't think there's any type of cancer that radiation is the only known cause of.
I see.
There's no silver bullet. You can't say this.
Yeah.
This particular cancer was caused by a particular radioactive element. You know, it's just no way to tell.
Mm-hmm. And what I was kind of wondering about is, as we keep having more emissions, we keep, you know, we've built a lot of nuclear power plants, and we have probably military reactors operating, and we have these accidents that happen, like Fukushima and Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, and all of this, I would think, contributes to the background radiation going up. So when they say things are more dangerous than background radiation, I don't find that very reassuring, considering that it's on the rise.
Well, right. Over the last 30, 40 years, what the government calls background radiation levels has jumped about sixfold. And the official explanations for it are, one, when it went up from about 100 millirems a year, which is, you know, what we would consider background radiation, 60 to 100 millirems a year, you know, from the sun and, you know, truly unavoidable things. When it jumped from that to about 300 or so per year, the cause was said to be radon in the soil. The problem, of course, being that not all areas have radon in their soil.
Mm-hmm.
Some do, and that certainly contributes to background radiation in those areas, but it's not, you know, nationwide. And more recently, the figures have been upped again to, I've seen as high as 600 millirems a year described as background radiation, and the official cause is said to be people getting more MRIs and CAT scans and things. But again, those are a voluntary, you know, generally voluntary type procedures, and B, that, you know, most of the population doesn't get in any given year.
Yeah.
You know, clearly a part of the increase has been, first of all, the above ground weapons tests from, you know, the 1940s and 50s and 60s and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
As well as nuclear power and other nuclear facility emissions from all over the world.
And
as we've seen, you know, once it gets out there, it's going to continue circling the world, and that's what it does.
So 50 years ago, what was the background radiation measurement? Roughly.
When I first began working in this arena about 25 years ago, background radiation was generally considered to be 100 millirems per year or so.
Wow, so that's a huge increase. So that's that's sixfold since you started.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's why when they assure us that it's no worse than background radiation, and I think during the same period we've seen cancer rates increase by, I forget what the percentage is, I think it's 30% or something like that, which is enormous.
I don't know that.
Yeah, I just heard it, and I can't quite remember if that's correct or not. Well, Michael, you've been great to stay on the phone so long, and I really appreciate it. We've been talking to Michael Marriott from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And once again, Michael, if people want to support this nonprofit organization, how do they do that?
Just go to www.nirs.org. Sign up for our alert list. If you can, make a donation and stay in touch with us.
All right. Michael, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
As I prepare this show to air on the 13th of April, 2011, I'm looking at the Nuclear Information Resource Service website at nirs.org, and I'm reading that The Japanese government has officially upgraded the status of the Fukushima accident to level 7, which is the highest level. In doing so, however, the government appears to be downplaying the actual radiation releases, with several media reports this morning quoting government officials as saying releases have been about 10% of those from Chernobyl. However, the Nuclear Information Resource Service reported here on March 23rd, the Austrian Weather Service, which has been monitoring radiation sources across the world and advising the International Atomic Energy Agency, said that releases of cesium-137 at that time were already at 20-60% of those of Chernobyl, and iodine-131 releases were at 20%. Please note that this updated release puts the cesium-137 releases at 50% of those of Chernobyl. Meanwhile, Greenpeace, which issued a statement March 25th saying that Fukushima was already a level 7 accident at that time, referred both to the Austrian study and a study by French nuclear officials. And you can find those statements posted at the Nuclear Information Resource Service, which is nirs.org. The world's media also appear to be missing another important story, the quote evacuation of 5 more villages to the northwest of Fukushima. It is not really an evacuation. It is a permanent relocation. If people were being evacuated to avoid a potentially immediately threatening radiation dose, the evacuation would not take weeks or even a month. It would happen in hours. Rather, the Japanese government has acknowledged that radiation levels in those villages, although outside the established exclusion zone, are too high to allow long-term habitation. Thus, people will leave from those villages and will not return. That's it for Politics and Science this week. I've been your host, John Barkhausen. Please stay tuned for another episode at the same time next week. Some podcasts of the show are available at radio4all.net. That's radio4all.net. And when you get there, search for Politics and Science, A-N-D, Science. The preceding show did present the viewpoints of its participants. It did not necessarily represent an official viewpoint of any other person or organization.